Hi, Dave Emery here. This is side one of For the Record program number 828, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on January 4th of the year 2015. Well, Happy New Year, everybody. I'm not sure how happy this is going to be. I suspect it's going to be a rather unhappy New Year, but we will see what happens. We're going to be looking back at some things that happened in the last year or even further back, and also looking ahead to things that may happen in the future. I hope not, but I'm afraid that some of them will. One of the leading news stories of the past year was President Obama's normalization of diplomatic relations with Cuba. That is something that has been relatively well received around the world, but some people have, of course, criticized that. I guess that shows us how far we have come, because the attempt by President Kennedy to normalize relations with Cuba back in the fall of 1963 appears to have been one of the factors that led to his death. We're going to go back into the archives, and we're going to listen to an excerpt from Anti-Fascist Archives, AFA program number 12, the third program in our four-part series about the Aryan Nations and the evolution of American fascism. This program was recorded on October 24th of 1985. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me very capably with the on-air responsibilities.
Okay, I'm going to read you a section from the book Conspiracy by Anthony Summers. And this chapter, which we're going to read the first couple of pages, is called Countdown to Conspiracy, and it begins with this quote: "There is no doubt in my mind, if there had been no assassination, we probably would have moved into negotiations leading to a normalization of relations with Cuba." Ambassador William Atwood. Just before starting this, let me once again explain to those of you who are younger and who are not, you know, who are in your 20s or younger, it's hard to understand this these days, even with the Reagan administration in power, what a bête noire, what a monkey on the back of the Cold Warriors the fact that that Cuba remained a communist nation was. 90 miles off the American coast, it was the focus of so much lamenting and gnashing of teeth among the right wing and the American intelligence and military establishments. You just cannot believe it. It was the major focus of public attention during most of the late Eisenhower and early Kennedy years. On September 17, 1963, an American and an African met over coffee at United Nations headquarters in New York. The African was a little-known diplomat, but what he had to discuss could have changed the course of modern history. Ambassador Seydou Diallo, Ghanaian envoy to Cuba, brought word from Havana. As his American contact, he had selected Ambassador William Atwood, special advisor to the United States delegation at the UN. Diallo knew and trusted Atwood as a former American ambassador to Guinea, but there was more to the choice than that. Not only had Atwood met and talked with Fidel Castro since the revolution, but he was on close personal terms with President Kennedy and his most important advisors. Now, seated in a corner of the delegates' lounge at the United Nations, Atwood listened while the African ambassador talked carefully. The burden of his message was that, after more than 3 years of confrontation, Fidel Castro wanted to reach some sort of understanding with the United States. According to Diallo, Castro was especially unhappy about the way Cuba was becoming tied to the Soviet Union and was looking for a way out while there was still time. Castro was at odds with international communists in the Cuban leadership, such as Che Guevara, and hoped to redress the balance by finding an accommodation with the United States. The stalemate between the two countries had lasted long enough, and it was time to break it. "Castro," said Ambassador Diallo, "is salvageable." In practical terms, the African suggested, it would not go amiss if Atwood found a way to talk to the Cuban delegate at the United Nations, Carlos Lechuga. The African had spoken like a strictly unofficial intermediary, carefully but with deliberation. Ambassador Atwood knew well that, in the world of diplomacy, conversations over coffee are often less casual than they seem. In recent weeks, other sources had given Atwood the same impression, that after more than 3 years of confrontation, Castro wanted talks about talks. In 1963 terms, this had a potential for breakthrough as momentous as the first tentative contacts between Egypt and Israel in the 70s. Atwood reported what was in the air to his immediate boss, United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson. He also briefed Averill Harriman, Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. Both men reacted with keen interest, and Stevenson promptly called the White House to discuss the new development with the president himself. Should Atwood go ahead and meet a Castro representative? In terms of American public policy, any sort of dialogue with Castro would be a startling change, of course. To many, including top officials at the CIA and the State Department, the very idea was heresy. Castro was to be overthrown, not wooed. President Kennedy was wary, but he had an open mind. 9 months ago, his presidential advisor on foreign affairs, McGeorge Bundy, had proposed finding some way to talk to Castro. In April, American negotiator James Donovan, back from talks in Havana about prisoner exchanges, had reported that Castro was concerned about Soviet domination. Castro had asked how Havana and Washington could go about resuming diplomatic relations, and Donovan had replied, quote, "the way porcupines make love," very carefully. Now, Kennedy felt, the time had perhaps come to start that interesting experiment. The idea was, after all, wholly in line with the president's search for peaceful alternatives. 3 weeks earlier, the hotline telephone link between the White House and the Kremlin had been opened, itself a symbol of determination to bring the United States and Russia into closer touch on sensitive issues. In the coming month, Kennedy and Khrushchev would sign the nuclear test ban treaty. The president publicly projected the return of 1,000 troops from Vietnam, the first stage of a withdrawal program that was to bring all American personnel home within 2 years. On Vietnam, the president knew, he was in direct conflict with a strong body of opinion within the CIA, which was virtually running the war. The CIA was generally against withdrawal and looked sourly on the president's policy of global disengagement. Publicly, the president was trying to conceal these fundamental disagreements. Privately, he was seriously concerned. One of his last acts was to commission a task force to review United States intelligence activities. Meanwhile, Kennedy intended to grasp opportunities for peace when they presented themselves. In June, the president's advisory group on Cuba had agreed it would be a good thing, in theory, to start a dialogue with Havana. Now the opening was there. In his September telephone call with Adlai Stevenson, John Kennedy made a snap decision. Atwood was to go ahead and meet Carlos Lechuga, the Cuban delegate to the UN, as soon as he liked, but on two conditions. On no account must it appear that the United States was soliciting the discussions. The contact was to be informal and top secret. Secret meant not telling the State Department bureaucracy or the CIA. In New York, Ambassador Atwood received the news with satisfaction. He was personally eager for an end to the Cuban deadlock, and he had a ready-made device for the delicate contact with Lechuga. A television correspondent, Lisa Howard of the American Broadcasting Company, had recently been to Havana and secured a scoop interview with Castro. He had expressed satisfaction over the Kennedy crackdown on exile raiding parties, and Howard, too, had returned with a feeling that Castro was ready to talk. She was already in touch with Atwood and on good terms with Cuban officials at the United Nations. Atwood took her into his confidence, swearing her to secrecy, on the understanding that if the talks came to anything, she would have an exclusive story. For her part, Lisa Howard was to give a small cocktail party. On September 23rd at 9 o'clock, a dozen carefully selected guests gathered in Howard's Manhattan apartment. Ambassador Atwood was there, and so was Castro's man at the UN, Carlos Lechuga. Atwood broke the ice by recalling how he had enjoyed talking to Castro in 1959, and Lechuga responded by saying, not so casually, that he believed Castro still liked talking. Sitting at a discreet distance from the other guests, the two diplomats chatted cautiously for half an hour. Lechuga said that Castro had appreciated Kennedy's recent moves to ease Cold War tensions, and had particularly liked the president's June speech on making the world, quote, safe for diversity. As for a next step, Atwood said he would be glad to talk to Castro if the invitation came from Havana. and if the White House approved. As Atwood told me when I interviewed him in 1978, quote, I left the party with the clear impression the Cubans were seriously interested in talking. We agreed to keep in touch. He then moved fast. The next morning saw him on an early air shuttle to Washington and a meeting with the president's brother. Attorney General Robert Kennedy thought an Atwood visit to Cuba might appear to commit the United States too much and wondered if a Castro meeting could be arranged on neutral territory, perhaps in Mexico. As a first step, it might be best if Atwood met a Castro emissary in New York. 2 days later, Atwood met Lechuga again at the United Nations. Almost apologetically, the Cuban said he would shortly be making an obligatory anti-American speech in the United Nations Assembly, just as Kennedy had done a few days earlier against the Havana regime. The White House, said Lechuga, should not read too much into it. Meanwhile, he would ask Havana whether they favored sending someone for talks to New York. The wheels of state were turning slowly and secretly. The secrecy side of things bothered Robert Kennedy a lot. It was, he had told Atwood, quote, bound to leak.
Continuing here, what did you want to say? Well, actually, let me tell you that you're broadcasting from Foothill College. This is KFJC Los Altos Hills. We're broadcasting from Foothill College. This is KFJC Los Altos Hills. Our business is taken care of. Continuing with Summers' account in conspiracy. At exactly this time, the CIA made its first contacts in nearly a year with Rolando Cubela, C-U-B-E-L-A, the traitor in Castro's inner circle. Without the knowledge of either the Kennedys or their director, or their own director, a small group of CIA officers prepared to use Cubela to remove Castro. In Washington, ignorant of this, President Kennedy and his aides proceeded quietly with plans for friendly contact with the man their own intelligence agency was trying to kill. And again, interrupting here, the departure of our intelligence services from all constitutional and presidential authority was front and center in, well, it's an underlying theme for, or an overt theme, really, for all of our programs. But Guns of November, number one, the background of the Kennedy assassination, we talked about this at great length. Also, number three. Continuing. Through October, as the days ticked by to tragedy in Dallas, this is October of 63, the White House began asking Ambassador Atwood what progress he was making. The answer was that the Cuban bureaucracy was reacting at Latin speed, very slowly. Havana's foreign ministry, it seemed, was not giving the matter high priority. Atwood, by now personally committed to the peace effort, began to take some initiatives of his own. He angled for ways of ensuring that Castro personally understood the new feeling in the White House. In early October, he learned that the eminent French journalist Jean Daniel of L'Express was in the United States on his way to Havana. As Atwood noted in his diary, Daniel felt, too, that Cuba was ripe for bold diplomacy, unquote. Together with Ben Bradley, then Washington bureau chief of Newsweek, Atwood urged President Kennedy to see the Frenchman. At first, the president did not respond, but he changed his mind promptly on learning that Daniel might soon be seeing Castro. At an interview in mid-October, Kennedy expounded his thoughts on Cuba. The essence of the problem, he told Daniel, was that Castro had betrayed the revolution by becoming, quote, a Soviet agent in Latin America, unquote, and that it was his actions which had brought the world to the brink of nuclear war and the missile crisis. As President Kennedy said, he could not tolerate continued communist subversion in Latin America. On the other hand, the president surprised Daniel by vigorous approval for the principle of Cuba's own revolution. He said the United States must take most of the blame for the evils of the old Batista regime. I have, said Kennedy, understood the Cubans, unquote. He asked Daniel to come and see him again on his return from Havana to report on Castro's attitude. Daniel and Castro in his turn some weeks later understood that Daniel was to be an unofficial envoy, unquote. Meanwhile, in New York, Ambassador Atwood had been receiving inquiries from the White House about his progress with official contacts. In late October, he decided to bypass the Cuban foreign ministry and get a message through to Castro personally. Atwood did so by using the television journalist Lisa Howard to telephone Dr. Rene Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, Castro's personal doctor and trusted aide. A string of telephone calls went out to Cuba from Howard's Manhattan apartment. On October 29th, there was movement. Vallejo tentatively brought up the idea that an American official, it was agreed this would be Atwood, should fly to meet Castro at Veradero, a resort on Cuba's north coast. Ambassador Atwood briefed Adlai Stevenson at the United Nations and then shuttled to Washington to brief the White House. On his return, he was able to note in his diary, quote, President more in favor of pushing this than the State Department, unquote. Kennedy was personally keen to press for an opening with Cuba to take Castro out of the Soviet fold and perhaps wiping out the Bay of Pigs and getting back to normal. However, the president would at this stage prefer a Cuban, perhaps Vallejo, to come to the United Nations for preliminary talks. Ambassador Atwood decided it was time to call Castro's aide himself and began a series of calls from Lisa Howard's apartment. Even getting through to Vallejo involved hours of wrestling with the telephone. Meanwhile, the president seized a new opportunity to make his feelings heard in Havana. On November 18th, 4 days before the assassination, he made an important speech in Miami, the city with the largest Cuban exile population in the United States. Kennedy said little to raise the hopes of the exiles, but much to interest listeners in Havana, just 200 miles across the water. He declared, quote, "It is important to restate what divides Cuba from my country. It is the fact that a small band of conspirators has stripped the Cuban people of their freedom and handed over the independence and sovereignty of the Cuban nation to forces beyond the hemisphere. They have made Cuba a victim of foreign imperialism, an instrument of the policy of others, a weapon in an effort dictated by external powers to subvert the other American republics. This, and this alone, divides us. As long as this is true, nothing is possible. Without it, everything is possible. Once Cuban sovereignty has been restored, we will extend the hand of friendship and assistance." In 1978, the historian Arthur Schlesinger, former special assistant to President Kennedy, explained the background and purpose of this speech. It had been written by the president's closest foreign policy advisors, including McGeorge Bundy, the aide most concerned with the Atwood negotiations. It was meant to reinforce what the president had said to Jean Daniel, that good relations were possible if Cuba ceased its interference in Latin American countries. Months earlier, Castro's aide Vallejo had taken a visiting American aside to explain that a rift had developed between the Cuban leader and some of his communist colleagues. Now, Kennedy's phrase about a small band of conspirators, unquote, was a thinly veiled reference to those hardliners, and the speech as a whole was designed to encourage Castro to stand firm against them. Above all, says Schlesinger, it was time to help Ambassador Atwood gain Fidel Castro's confidence. The President of the United States wanted to find a way to reopen relations, yet behind his back, the CIA twisted his words into a very different message. CIA officials had been continuing their contacts with Castro's disaffected aide, Rolando Cubella. As the Senate Intelligence Committee learned in 1975, they had started discussing Castro's assassination with him and promised him lethal equipment, all without the authority of the government. At the end of October, the head of the CIA's Cuba unit, Desmond Fitzgerald, masquerading as an American senator, had told Cubella that a coup against Castro would have the full backing of the United States government. A month after both Kennedys had given their personal support to peace feelers, the CIA senator had told Cubella he came as Robert Kennedy's personal representative. After the Miami speech, a CIA officer compounded the untruth. He told Cubella that the senator had helped write the speech, which he had not, and he claimed the speech was meant as an indication that the president supported a coup. As Arthur Schlesinger told me in 1978, the whole Cuba thing raises even deeper questions. The CIA was reviving the assassination plots at the very time President Kennedy was considering the possibility of normalization of relations with Cuba, an extraordinary action. If it was not total incompetence, it was a studied attempt to subvert national policy. Schlesinger suggests the most sinister explanation for such perfidy. Both he and Ambassador Atwood today believe it likely that, just as the president and his brother had feared, the exchanges between Washington and Havana had leaked. Atwood had been instructed to maintain extreme secrecy over the whole matter. On the president's orders, only half a dozen senior officials of state had been in the know. The CIA, specifically, had not been told. With hindsight, though, there were two glaring security loopholes. The CIA had long penetrated the Cuban mission at the United Nations with anti-Castro agents. The National Security Agency intercepted calls to Havana, and U.S. intelligence agencies reaped the harvest of information. From late October and probably earlier, Atwood's intermediary, Lisa Howard, made a series of phone calls to Castro's closest confidant. In at least one of these, she told Havana of the president's personal commitment to the Atwood efforts. Arthur Schlesinger says now, quote, "I think the CIA must have known about this initiative. They must certainly have realized that Bill Atwood and the Cuban representative to the UN were doing more than exchanging daiquiri recipes when they met. They had all of the wires tapped at the Cuban delegation to the UN. Ambassador Atwood now realizes the telephone calls were insecure and is nagged by a sinister possibility. He says, quote, If the CIA did find out what we were doing, this would have trickled down to the lower echelon of activists and Cuban exiles and the more gung-ho CIA people who had been involved since the Bay of Pigs. If word of a possible normalization of relations with Cuba leaked to those people, I can understand why they would have reacted violently. This was the end of their dreams of returning to Cuba, and they might have been impelled to take violent action, such as assassinating the president.
I just want to point that out again, those last words. This is a former ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson's, one of his right-hand men, talking about the fact that he himself can see in this one event alone, and that's eliminating many of the other things we've talked about, such as the Vietnam situation, that in this one event alone, he could see the possibility of CIA people being enraged enough at John F. Kennedy to perpetrate an assassination. We're going to read a little bit more, continuing from Conspiracy by Anthony Summers. As the president flew home from Miami, Ambassador Atwood was on his way to yet another tussle with the telephone in Lisa Howard's apartment. Still trying to nail down an acceptable formula for talks, the ambassador and Vallejo had been thwarted by telephone delays and broken connections. At last, in the early morning hours of November 19th, they did have a proper conversation. Although Atwood did not know it at the time, Vallejo was relaying Castro's immediate personal reactions. The Cuban leader was sitting beside him throughout the conversation. Clearly, Castro wanted to handle the whole matter personally. He was still insisting that the American representative should find a way to come to Cuba. Castro, after all, could not come to the United States. In accordance with American wishes, though, the Cubans would submit an agenda through their office at the United Nations. Castro gave an assurance that Che Guevara, one of the hardline communists and an apostle of global revolution, would not take part in the meeting. Atwood noted that the voice at the Cuban end of the telephone sounded, quote, very eager about the proposed talks. Within 24 hours, Castro would finally meet with French journalist Jean Daniel. Since arriving in Havana, fresh from his White House talk with President Kennedy, he had waited in vain for an interview. Now, in a talk that lasted till dawn, Castro made Daniel repeat time and again what Kennedy had said about his personal approval of the revolution and his criticism of Castro's foreign policies. Castro defended his role in the missile crisis and said he could not, for now, discuss the future of Cuba's links with the Soviet Union. Yet he did see hope for a breakthrough with the United States in the person of President Kennedy. Castro said of the president, quote, he still has the possibility of becoming, in the eye of history, the greatest president of the United States, the leader who may at last understand that there can be coexistence between capitalists and socialists, even in the Americas. He would then be an even greater president than Lincoln. I know, for example, that for Khrushchev, Kennedy is a man you can talk with. Other leaders have assured me that to attain this goal, we must first await his re-election. Personally, I consider him responsible for everything. But I will say this, he has come to understand many things over the past few months, and what's more, in the last analysis, I'm convinced that anyone else would be worse. Then, with a grin, Castro added, if you see him again, you can tell him that I'm willing to declare Goldwater my friend, if that will guarantee Kennedy's re-election. Since you are going to see Kennedy again, be an emissary of peace. Unquote. Early in the morning of November 19th, still weary from his marathon telephone stint during the night, Ambassador Atwood placed a call from New York to the White House. He briefed McGeorge Bundy, the president's advisor on foreign affairs, on the latest contact with Castro. The president, as Robert Kennedy would later relate, had given the go-ahead. Atwood was to go to Havana and, quote, see what could be done to effect a normalization of relationship. Bundy told Atwood that president would want to brief him as soon as the Cubans came up with an agenda. Kennedy would not be leaving Washington, said Bundy, except for a brief visit to Texas. Texas was Dallas, and the president came back in a coffin. The next chapter is Chapter 22, The First Stone. A little quote at the beginning, time's glory is to calm contending kings, to unmask falsehood and bring truth to light, William Shakespeare. 4 days after John Kennedy's funeral, President Lyndon Johnson brusquely summoned the Chief Justice of the United States to the White House. He told Earl Warren in melodramatic terms that it was his national duty to head the Commission of Inquiry into the murder of John Kennedy. If certain rumors were not stopped, said Johnson. They could lead the United States, quote, into a war which could cost 40 million lives. He was more specific than that. Johnson said, if the public became aroused against Castro and Khrushchev, there might be war. 10 months later, the Warren Commission reported that no foreign government played any role in the assassination. So far as Cuba was concerned, if public statements meant anything, this had been clear within hours. Havana's ambassador to the United Nations, the man who had been helping arrange a dialogue between Washington and Havana, said, quote, despite the antagonisms existing between the government of the United States and the Cuban Revolution, we have received with profound displeasure the news of the tragic death of President Kennedy, unquote. In Cuba, the French journalist Jean Daniel had actually been with Castro when the news of the shooting came through. Castro, Daniel would later recall, was utterly shocked. Slumped in his chair, he said, es una mala noticia. This is bad news. He repeated that 3 times and then, since the first bulletin had said only that the president was wounded, expressed hope that the president would recover and automatically be reelected. When the death was confirmed, Castro remarked, quote, everything is changed. Everything is going to change. The Cold War, relations with Russia, Latin America, Cuba, the Negro question, all will have to be rethought. I'll tell you one thing, at least Kennedy was an enemy to whom we had become accustomed. This is a serious matter, an extremely serious matter. Later, as the American radio station announced that the assassin was a member of Fair Play for Cuba and an admirer of Fidel Castro, the Cuban leader declared, quote, if they had proof, they would have said he was an agent, an accomplice, a hired killer. In saying simply that he was an admirer, this is just to try and make an association in people's name, in people's minds between the name of Castro and the emotion awakened by the assassination. This is a publicity method, a propaganda device. This is terrible. Then, as the radio began calling Oswald a pro-Castro Marxist, Castro called off his engagements. The Cuban government was in fear of a swift revenge strike by the armed forces of the United States. No such thing happened, but Castro had been right about the reflex action of many in the United States.
So basically, we've seen, once again, the conflict between the presidential authority and the military and intelligence services resolve irrevocably in favor of the military and intelligence services and against the Constitution and eventually, of course, you and me. The point is that Kennedy was, obviously, as we've seen at great length, in the process of attempting to normalize relations with Castro's Cuba. This obviously met with no favor at all among those whose livelihoods, among other things, were dependent upon overthrowing Castro by military means. And this brought Kennedy squarely again up, face-to-face in an antagonistic way with the paramilitary milieu that we've been talking about, this Cuban Fry Corps. And, of course, it cost him his life. Now we're going to take a look at this this amalgam of supposedly negligible organizations and individuals and how they were involved, namely the Aryan Nations, and how they were involved with this paramilitary milieu, which reversed national policy. Recall that the actual trigger work in the Kennedy assassination was done by professional assassins, but the handling of Oswald and the creating of the myths, this was done by these people who were involved with the commando training against Cuba and so forth, the people we've been looking at. An indication of the role of these supposedly fringe right-wing groups in reversing national policy, and recall the almost certain intelligence leaks about Kennedy's approaches to Castro, again returning briefly to Conspiracy by Anthony Summers. In October, at a house in the Dallas suburb of Farmers Branch, the local John Birch Society hosted 3 venomously anti-Kennedy exiles. A member of the audience taped what was said and later provided the recording to a senior officer in the Dallas police. It remained a secret until 1978 when the policeman gave me a copy. On the tape, a Bay of Pigs veteran called Nestor Castellanos reviles the president. Get him out. Get him out. The quicker, the sooner, the better. He's doing all kinds of deals. Mr. Kennedy is kissing Mr. Khrushchev. I wouldn't be surprised if he had kissed Castro, too. I wouldn't even call him President Kennedy. He stinks. Castellanos had something else to say. He confided to his audience, quote, we are waiting for Kennedy the 22nd, buddy. We're going to see him in one way or the other. We're going to give him the works when he gets in Dallas. So recall that apparently the John Birch Society and elements thereof were in possession of what was supposed to be secret information at this point about Kennedy's approaches to Cuba.
And notice also their mention of the 22nd, saying that they were going to give him the works, as is noted later on in the book Conspiracy. There were no demonstrations by anti-Castro exiles on the 22nd. So if they were going to give him the works, it was in some other way than by a demonstration. And, of course, somebody gave John F. Kennedy the works on November 22nd.
That, again, from AFA program number 12, from October 24th of 1985. And, indeed, President Kennedy was given the works, unquote, on November 22nd, 1963. We now have an established tradition in this country of blaming large and lethal events on a lone nut. Political murder, sadly, has become something of a way of life in the U.S. at this point in time. And we are absolutely compulsive as a nation about blaming really important things on one lone nut, and that person becomes something of a totem sacrificial lamb who is the focal point of all of the bad stuff that just happened. That appears to have been the case with regard to the anthrax attacks back in 2001. For younger listeners, right around the time of the September 11th attacks, actually shortly thereafter, a number of letters containing deadly anthrax spores were sent to various public figures and media outlets. Eventually, that was blamed on Dr. Bruce Ivins, last name I-V-I-N-S. He was a scientist at Fort Detrick, military's top biological warfare research facility, and the investigation was closed. The available evidence, however, suggests that whether or not Ivins was involved, and that is involved at all, and that is up in the air, shall we say, he certainly does not appear to have been the only individual involved. I've done many programs and posts about the anthrax mailings. Go to the SpitfireList.com website and just put open quote anthrax, close quotes, or there's a tag, hashtag, for anthrax. One of the possibilities that was not really investigated is the possibility that people who had been involved in covert operations involving anthrax and biological warfare and who were affiliated with Nazi and fascist organizations may have used their considerable expertise to do this on their own. And in addition, obviously, the possibilities of governmental elements being involved, the possibility of elements that were involved with the government and then took their expertise and went off on their own to do what they had been paid to do by the government remains to be seen. In particular, I remain very suspicious of people associated with elements of the CIA, like Dr. Larry Ford, who had been involved in assisting the apartheid government of South Africa with their Project Coast biological warfare program. The General Accountability Office, or Accounting Office, has reviewed the anthrax study and has concluded that it was flawed. This from the New York Times of December 19th of 2014, an article by William J. Broad, B-R-O-A-D. Inquiry in anthrax mailings had gaps, report says, it reads in part. A congressional inquiry into the FBI's scientific work on the anthrax mailings of 2001 has identified major gaps in genetic evidence that purportedly links the germs to Bruce E. Ivins, the Army microbiologist blamed for attacks that killed 5 people, sickened 17 others, and shook the nation. More about the gaps in the genetic evidence continuing. The Government Accountability Office study, requested in 2010 and made public on Friday, echoes earlier criticism from the National Academy of Sciences. In 2011, its expert panel found that the Bureau's analysis of the genetic evidence, quote, did not definitively demonstrate a firm link between the mailed anthrax spores and a sample taken from Dr. Ivins' laboratory at Fort Detrick in Maryland, and more generally was, quote, not as conclusive, unquote, as the Bureau had asserted. The GAO had better access to FBI records and deepened the genetic critique, finding that the Bureau's investigation, quote, lacked several important characteristics, unquote, that could have strengthened its case. Again, quoting, a key scientific gap, the 77-page report said, was the Bureau's failure to investigate whether samples of anthrax spores could naturally mutate enough to obscure their putative links to Dr. Ivins, skipping down. The deadly wisps of anthrax coming just after the September attacks set off new waves of panic. Over the years, a growing number of outside experts have asked whether federal investigators got the right man and whether the FBI's long inquiry brushed aside important clues. To the regret of independent scientists, the report made no mention of an issue beyond genetics, whether the spores displayed signs of advanced manufacturing. They have pointed to distinctive chemicals found in the dried anthrax spores that they say contradict FBI claims that the germs were unsophisticated. Evidence of special coatings, they say, suggests that Dr. Ivins had help in obtaining his germ weapons or that he was innocent. And again, go to the SpitfireList.com website, just use the search function, quote, anthrax, unquote, and there is a lot of information that I have posted about the investigation into the anthrax case, or the anthrax attacks. In the For the Record 825, we examined the recapitulation of key aspects of fascist dictator Francisco Franco's regime in Spain by Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy and his popular party. As we looked at in 825, Mariano Rajoy's popular party essentially is something of a kinder, gentler falange. It is just a reworking of elements of Franco's falange fascist party with something of a smiley face put on the front to make it look much more benign. That benign facade is rapidly being stripped away by the slings and arrows of reality. And again, Mariano Rajoy's popular party is starting to become much more like a falange 2, so to speak, or falange 2.0. Kevin Matthews, writing in the Truth Out blog of December 23rd of 2014, has noted an ominous turn in the Spanish regime's attitude toward those protesting its policies. Spanish government strips away protesting rights, again by Kevin Matthews, Truth Out, December 23rd of 2014, reads in part, what's a government to do when the people take to the street to protest the way the country is being run? A sensible government would change the policies to appease the people it is committed to serving. Alternately, a government could take Spain's current approach, which is to start fining and arresting people for protesting in the first place. Yes, that will solve the problem. Spain is showing signs of fascism with its new anti-protest legislation nicknamed the Gag Law, unquote. This past week, Spain's lower parliament okayed the law, pushing it much closer to reality. And it notes many very benign things that could be punished by a very large fine, holding a protest in front of a government building, protesting the day before an election, photographing or filming police officers, protesting at a bank, and other things. The text of the entire post is in the description for the Record 828. Skipping down and resuming. That's not all. Even peaceful protests can be shut down if police fear that the protest could at some point turn disorderly, unquote, left to the police's discretion, obviously. Oh, and don't even think about appealing these fines in court.